Our second case this morning is United States against Von Bergen. Counsel for defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, members of this honorable court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Philip Foreman, and along with Major Shannon Bennett, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class David J. Von Bergen. The issue in this case is whether the military judge erred by applying the appellant's waiver to his Article 32 rights in September 2001 to his October 2006 court-martial. Briefly, as a factual overview, in 2001, appellant was charged with violating the Child Pornography Prevention Act as incorporated under Clause 3 of the General Article 134. He was also charged with distribution of child pornography in violation of Clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134. Appellant provided an offer for a pretrial agreement, which he signed on the 10th of September 2001, where he offered to waive his Article 32 for the charge and specifications. The convening authority accepted the pretrial agreement, and there was a conditional waiver of the Article 32, which was conditioned upon the acceptance of the pretrial agreement. In September of 2001, pursuant to appellant's pleas, he was found guilty of both specifications. In 2005, this court set aside the finding for specification one.
Assuming we understand the procedural history, which is your strongest argument? You put a number of arguments on the table. Which one do you think is your strongest argument?
Your Honor, under Medina, as applied to this case, appellant's waiver of his Article 32 rights in 2001 was not knowing and voluntary as applied to the 2006 court-martial, because under Medina, clauses 1 and 2, the amended specification, was not a lesser-included offense to the original specification.
Do you think, does that imply that the waiver was still valid and would have waived 801 absent Medina?
Your Honor, it does not imply that, because Medina, for other reasons, Your Honor, there was a major change in this case. Clauses 1 and Clauses 2 and Clauses 3, they're separate clauses of Article 134. And, Your Honor,
which is a different theory as well.
Alternate theories, yes,
yeah.
Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. But you would say that your Medina is your best argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though, quite frankly, it wasn't cited in your original brief.
Yes, Your Honor. Under Griffith v. Kentucky, the retroactive application of Medina. Medina came out in 2008, and that was before the Air Force Court opinion came out. Appellant raised the significant change between clauses 1 and 2 in the original specification, and Medina is applied to that significant change because the appellant did not, under Garcia, have a knowing and voluntary waiver to that new specification.
Is the law that only a change can be made to establish a lesser-included offense? Is that the only change that can be made that would be in the nature of a minor change?
Your Honor, under 603, there are other minor changes that can be made after arraignment. However, if there is prejudice to a substantial pretrial right, the military judge should not allow that change. In this case, there was prejudice to a substantial pretrial right, and that was his right to an Article 32 hearing, which appellant requested and did not receive.
Where's the prejudice here? I mean, what would he have gotten out of a new 32? You're saying he was prejudiced by not getting a new 32.
Yes, Your Honor.
What did that, as a practical matter, deny him?
Your Honor, an Article 32 would have provided an impartial and thorough investigation of the charge and specification. In this case, there was an amendment to the specification. During the five-year span between 2001 and 2006, OSI had destroyed the computer evidence that would have been used to establish charge one specification, charge and specification one. In addition, memory has faded. The investigating officer may have not recommended going forward to court-martial in 2006. It's possible he or she may have recommended special court-martial as opposed to a general court-martial, which would have meant the maximum would have been a bad conduct discharge and 12 months confinement as opposed to a dishonorable discharge and 20 years.
Your argument,
the evidence was destroyed, you say? Was it, what was on the table then?
Your Honor, at the evidence that was presented at the court-martial, appellant's care inquiry, the statements to OSI, care inquiry from the first court-martial, and there were a couple of witnesses, including a staff sergeant, Nuccio, who testified under a grant of testimonial immunity at the court-martial.
And there was no computer evidence or picture evidence presented?
Your Honor, there was witness testimony that appellant had presented pictures which appeared to be child pornography from a layman's perspective, but there was no photographic evidence presented or forensic studies done on the computers at the second court-martial.
Is the issue of prejudice the prejudice that he didn't have an Article 32, or is it the prejudice that the military judge did not correctly rule on the motion? That is, if the military judge did not correctly rule on the motion, then we look into the prejudice as to what was the consequence of that. And in this case, the consequence was that the charge went forward with a change.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what happened at trial with respect to that change that would show that the accused was prejudiced? Was there any evidence introduced that wasn't available at the Article 32?
Your Honor, it's difficult to say what would have been introduced at the Article 32.
I'm not asking about what would have been introduced at the Article 32. Here, we're now saying that the judge erred in not granting a new Article 32. Well, where's the prejudice from not having an Article 32? What has the accused shown us as to what the government used at trial in the second time around that wasn't available the first time around?
Appellant pled not guilty the second court-martial.
Right.
Pled guilty the first court-martial. In the first court-martial as well, appellant gave an unsworn statement in which he contested some of the evidence admitted for the appellate exhibits admitted by the government. Staff Sergeant Nuccio testified that he downloaded child pornography in the second court-martial. It's possible that had there been a thorough investigation, perhaps that would have been developed more and would have perhaps gone to mitigation of the sentence at the court-martial.
But the only thorough investigation that he was prejudiced in not having was a thorough investigation into the issue of service discrediting or prejudice to good order and discipline. The other information was all known to the accused at the time that he waived the Article 32, and he nonetheless waived it. He decided that he wasn't interested in having an Article 32. So all that's happening now is that the government's now being required to prove that it was either service discrediting or prejudicial to good order and discipline. If the government didn't introduce any further evidence on those issues, but simply allowed on the inference that trial counsel argued at trial, where's the prejudice? Nothing new has been introduced against the accused that wasn't available then.
Your Honor, he has a right to an Article 32 under Article 32 and RCM 45.
Well, let's say that they didn't have an Article 32 and he had the right to have it. Let's say it was a total error for whatever reason at trial in not giving him an Article 32. Isn't there still a requirement for a showing of prejudice before we reverse?
Yes, Your Honor, and because it was handled at a general court-martial and resulted in a conviction when there was the destruction of significant amounts of evidence.
All right. Well, let me ask you maybe a related question, which is, You know, what's your best argument that if there had been an Article 32, things would not have turned out exactly the way that they did, meaning that it would have ended up at the court-martial that it ended up at, right? Because that's the best that you could get from an Article 32 would be that it would be recommended that it not go to a court-martial and that it wouldn't go to a court-martial.
Can you answer your question?
Yeah. What evidence do you have that if there had been an Article 32, which is what you're saying the prejudice was, right, that he was entitled to an Article 32 investigation and he didn't get one, what evidence do you have or what's your best argument that things would not have ended up exactly where they did?
You know, the change in the state of evidence is the best argument that we have.
Okay, well,
that could possibly have resulted in a special court-martial as opposed to a general. In addition, it could have perhaps resulted in a lesser degree of sentence had the opportunity been presented for Staff Sergeant Nuccio to be cross-examined under oath at a hearing prior to the actual trial. And an Article 32 hearing would have allowed that.
The error took, if there's an error, it took place in not having the 32 at the time of the first charge. Is that correct? The ultimate error, if we drill right down into the defense allegation of error, it was that there was not an opportunity to request a 32 at the time, because if he had known that the charge was service discrediting or prejudicial to good order and discipline, he would have asked for a 32.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would he have done?
Can I just verify? You saying that's the error, or the error was not having it 5 years later before the new charge?
The error was not having the Article 32 to the new specification.
Right. So but 5 years later.
Yes, sir. Right.
I'm talking first about the underlying error in the case that would then generate the second error.
Well, you're not suggesting that there was an error in not having an Article 32 the first time, are you?
No, Your Honor.
Because both parties at the time thought that he could plead guilty to the charge that he pleaded guilty to, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was part of the consideration he got for his pretrial agreement, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then Martinelli came out and we said, reconsider, you can't plead guilty to it. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But ultimately, even though that at the time the judge would not have known that he had to, that and the individual would not have known that the charge had to be alleged under articles, under clauses 1 and 2, at that time, had the law been applied correctly, as later determined in Martinelli, the underlying problem in the case is that he made his waiver not knowing what the law would be. Isn't that the underlying problem in the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if he had known, what would he have done at that time? We don't know whether he would have pled or not. But assuming he had the opportunity at that time to see that the charge should be under clauses 1 and 2, what would have been different about that Article 32 proceeding?
Back in 2001.
Right.
Your Honor, the appellants would speculate there wouldn't have been much of a difference.
Right. So if there wouldn't have been much of a difference, why is it error 5 years later for the judge to say, well, I'm going to go through the same analysis and say, where is this accused being hurt? Because I understand the argument you're making that his hurt is taking place in not having the 32 now. But the issue is whether his waiver was proper back then. And if his waiver was improper because he wasn't aware of the need to charge under Clause 1 and Clause 2, why shouldn't we measure the harm by asking what would he have done if he had known that the case should have been charged under Clause 1 and Clause 2. And so far, we've determined nothing because the prosecution didn't introduce any new evidence on that issue, and the defense wouldn't have had anything different to do at the time. So even though now his claim is that the judge erred by not giving him a new 32, and a new 32 would have been benefited by looking at all the evidence or the absence of the evidence that was destroyed, why does that make any difference when the issue is how was he harmed by not being able to make an informed waiver decision back at the time of the original trial?
Your Honor, back at the time of the original trial, he made the waiver decision that was available to him. In 2006, there was an amended specification. There was a change in circumstances with the evidence. And the second argument is that appellant showed good cause. There's good cause here for the waiver of the Article 32 under RCM 405K. Appellant, you know, in this case, the Nickerson case, for instance, was a case where this court in footnote 3 stated that where the plea was related to the Article 32 waiver, that was good cause for relief. In this case, the pre-trial agreement, which was drafted and signed back in 2001, as well as the waiver for the Article 32, was directly related to the guilty plea.
Let me try it another way. I know your time is up, and hopefully I'll make this short. If back at the time of the original proceeding, the government had decided during the course of the proceedings to amend the charge, to strike out the statutory Title 18 charge and make it a Clause 1 or Clause 2 offense, and he said, I want out of my waiver, I want a new Article 32, how would we have proceeded if the judge denied that?
Your Honor, you could perform an analysis of whether or not there was, under 405K, whether there was good cause. And back at that time, back in 2000, SAP was the rule. And SAP would have held that clauses 1 and 2 are lesser included offenses.
No, I'm saying let's. I'm not looking back at that time as to what the law was then and what it is now. But let's assume that the judge said no Article 32, and that was error. Wouldn't we then look at prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's no showing of prejudice, is there, as to how at that time, if the government had made the change. He would have been prejudiced. So if the government could have changed it back then without prejudice, why is his waiver still not good?
Your Honor, under Garcia, the court has stated that it's important for military judges to inform an appellant that the waiver is knowing and voluntary. And if there had been a waiver under Clause 3, and there was an amendment to Clauses 1 and 2, then the waiver would not apply to Clause 3 because it's separate alternate theories of criminality. And so it would not have been known. Okay. And that would have been the prejudice. In terms of prejudice to trial, the appellant would not foresee prejudice back in 2001.
Okay. Yes, sir. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Major Brendan K. Tukey, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, and represent the government in this matter. Well, in this case, Your Honor waived his right to an Article 32 hearing in part in an effort to secure a favorable pretrial agreement. And it worked. He got what he asked for and received the full benefit of that PTA in his first trial. Then, having gotten what he wanted and seeing no need for a PTA any longer, in the second trial, decided to withdraw and demand that which he had traded away in the first place, an Article 32 hearing. And in this regard, the accomplice, not unlike a customer who, when he rents a car, buys the full insurance for it, and on returning the car, goes, hey, I didn't have an accident after all. I guess I didn't need it.
If appellant hadn't waived, in your view, would he be entitled to, pursuant to 801 and Article 32 on rehearing?
The appellant had effectuated a waiver at the first trial.
If there's no waiver involved in this case, putting aside whether it's effective or not, just I'm trying to get it, ask you a pure question without the waiver piece.
I understand, Your Honor. I don't think he would have been entitled to it in the 30 chance at the second trial.
Under 801. Would he have been entitled to a new, to an Article 32 if instead of being the discredit, 134 discredit on child porn, it had been shoplifting?
Then possibly, because then we'd be looking at, I think the analysis would be, was this a major change that required a whole new referral, and was it necessarily required to be?
Oh, I see. That's where you're going with the 801. Let's say, let me back it up. I'm trying to make it a pure 801 question. let's say it's a major change, would he be entitled to an Article 32 under 801 absent the, without the waiver, if there'd been no waiver?
Had there been a waiver?
Conceding, just for the sake of the pure question, I'm just trying to get it, trying to make this an 801 question.
In the absence of a waiver and the and in it being a major change, I would, the government's position, I think, would be that it would be entitled to.
I mean, I'm just trying to understand your view of 801 before we start building in the other blocks. And so the effect of the waiver, you would agree that the waiver has to be knowing and meaningful and all that stuff?
Yes, Your Honor, it has to be a valid waiver.
And you're in the, and your argument is that he got what he asked for, which is if the judge did not accept the plea, the waiver would be invalid.
Well, there was a brief exchange on the record between the judge and the counsels in which they all agreed that it was not necessarily a permanent waiver, that the judge could not accept his guilty plea, or that if he withdrew from the PTA before he could be accepted, if the PTA can be completed, then he might be.
What about the military? Didn't the military judge also tell the accused defense counsel, if the accused plea of guilty is determined to be improvident, will the accused be afforded an Article 32 investigation, or is it permanently waived? Defense counsel, it's not permanently waived, ma'am. So it was contingent on the offer for pretrial agreement as well. Yes, ma'am. Might that have suggested to the appellant that it was not permanently waived, and if it was found improvident, he'd get to reconsider? I understand the PTA is predicated to the judge accepting, but why wouldn't that be viewed as confusing to the average appellate, the average accused, as to whether he's permanently waiving the 32 or not? You see what I'm getting at? Because both parties are working over one sentence in the record, and I'm focusing on a different sentence.
And your question is whether that would, might have been confusing to the average accomplice in terms of whether he can.
Right, it says, if the accused plea of guilty is determined to be improvident, will the accused be afforded an Article 32 investigation, or is it permanently waived? Defense counsel, it's not permanently waived, ma'am.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. So
and you're saying, no, but it was permanently waived because the convening authority performed on the pretrial agreement.
Well, I would think that our argument in that regard goes to the actual objection made at trial by the accused, which was all the sole argument that the second trial the accused made was, I withdrew from the PTA, therefore I should just get a new 32. There was no assertion that, gee, I was in any way confused or taken aback or things had changed or I wasn't ready to see these elements.
Counsel, if I may interject, I think that's whether that answers Judge Baker's question or not, it doesn't answer the question that I have out of that. And that is, did he waive permanently the Article 32 if the plea was found to be improvident?
No. Okay. I think he would have to, but it would be the same analysis. He wasn't at the same time being told that you have an absolute, you have a right, you're automatically going to get the 32.
I understand that. If we determine now that the plea was improvident, a matter that you're not conceding. If we determine now, where does the case stand?
If we determine now that that plea was improvident, the accused had every right to ask at a second trial to have that valid waiver revoked and to make showing that there's good cause for the valid waiver to be revoked. And if the judge had found good cause, the judge would have been, the proper thing of the judge would have been to order the 32 investigation. But there is no evidence whatsoever presented, or even the argument broached or made, that there was good cause for the new 32, other than he withdrew from the PTA.
If the plea was improvident, why does he have to argue that the waiver is revoked? Isn't the waiver revoked?
The waiver.
Why does he need the judge's permission to waive something that's no longer in effect?
I think it would be in effect, Your Honor. The written waiver, the conditional waiver that he submitted, said, GCMCA, if you sign this PTA and enter it into me, into it with me, I understand all these rights, this whole group of rights in Article 32, that I'm going to willingly give up now. It was a conditional waiver, but I think the waiver would still apply in the absence of showing a good cause for why.
But that was a waiver to 134.3, and so under Medina, why isn't this a new charge rather than a LIO? Your argument would work if it was a LIO, But under Medina, there was no discussion during the Providency inquiry of clauses one or two.
Well, Your Honor, I think the defense, we disagree with the defense's approach to Medina. I mean, Medina, I don't believe in reading, actually stands for the black and white proposition that none of clause three, clause one, and clause two, they can never be nullified to one another. And it leaves the door open that under some circumstances they could be. And they don't hold it. And Medina is focused on the fact that the accused entered a guilty plea to something that wasn't actually on the charge sheet. And
where was clause one and two on the charge sheet here?
Well, when he had at the initial trial, it wasn't, although Medina also makes a point of saying that, hey, it's obviously implicit and intuitive that these elements are at play when you're talking about this kind of conduct.
Are there not elements in one and two that are not present in three?
Pardon me, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Under Schmuck and its progeny, are there not elements in one and two that are not present in three and vice versa?
Yes, sir.
All right, then why isn't it not a major change, a new charge?
Well, if you look at, for example, language in Sullivan, there's not a pure test that it has to be an LIO for it to be a major or minor charge, a change. But that's not the key question. When you look at the RCM, you know, it tells us that, okay, is it a major change? Does it add a pardon? Clearly not at play here. Is it adding a new offense? This is still Article 134, and these elements are clearly implied by the nature of
it. I think you're making a lot of that line in Medina, because saying that something is intuitive and implicit doesn't mean that it's an element. I mean, I can say it's intuitive and implicit that someone, you know, doing X did something bad. That doesn't mean I'm saying it's a crime.
I agree, Your Honor. I think where that would go would be the other parts of the test where something a major change, including, you know, adding a substantial matter that the accused wasn't fairly included or was likely to be misled. And I think the intuitive language in Medina speaks to the fact that the accused is not likely to be misled by, you know, the sudden additions and any change. And that's borne out by the fact that
the language may have been there to point out that the focus was on fair notice, not on whether child porn is discredited.
Well, in Medina, the focus was on fair notice where the person is pleading guilty to something and the judge is sua sponte adding elements that weren't on the charge sheet, which is different than what's here. When the accused showed up at a second trial, the elements were on the charge sheet. He clearly was not surprised or felt in any way fairly disadvantaged because he never said a word about that in his objection. His pure point of trial was, I withdrew for the PTA, so effectively I get a 32.
Okay, well, let me focus you on something slightly different. All right, let's assume that the waiver for the first trial was not effective for the second trial. And let's say that the military judge was wrong to not give him an Article 32. All right. Focused, if you would, on why he was, what we're looking at in terms of assessing prejudice and why he was or was not prejudiced. I'm assuming you're going to argue he was not prejudiced, so.
Your Honor, you read my mind. when you got to look for prejudice, let's look at the record and see where is anything.
Well, first let me ask you a question, which is, are we looking at whether he was prejudiced by not getting a second Article 32, or are we looking at whether he should have, with the questions that Judge Efron was asking, which seemed to suggest that we looked at the prejudice at the time of the initial trial. What's your position?
I think the position the government would take was the awkward question is at the time the judge denied him the 32 investigation that he requested for the second trial, was that an error?
Okay, and what specifically are we looking at to assess the prejudice? Are we looking at whether he would have gotten a different result if there'd been an Article 32 than he got without the Article 32, or are we looking at something different?
Well, I think what we need to look at is, okay, what are the purposes of the 32? The 32 is meant to be a discovery tool. So is there any evidence recently that there's evidence that was at trial that the government wouldn't have been able to put on the 32, or that, you know, the accused is not disadvantaged because he didn't see that evidence? No, I mean, the evidence at trial was essentially the same, actually lesser than the evidence that we went the first time around, because the actual images that were issued and disposed of. But the meat of the case still remained the same, especially since the real meat of the case was the accused on statement, both Ms. Karen-Furry and OSI.
What about the testimony of the third party that testified under of a grant of immunity? What notice or what opportunity did the appellant have to discover, make have discovery on that particular piece of information?
Well, you know, obviously, I don't recall that the record says talks about what interviews were done or things like that. So I'm stuck. But going off of our practice and assuming in the lack of any objection from the defense that, hey, I'm shocked or caught by surprise by this guy, I didn't know that he was out there, I had a chance to interview and prepare for cross-examination. In the absence of all that, assuming that the area defense counsel working the case was competent area defense counsel, one would assume he was identified to the defense, they knew who he was, they had opportunities to interview him, that they could have if they felt a particular need to get a deposition or something like that, made that request. You know, there's no reason to believe that this immunized individual's testimony at trial somehow was a surprise to them or something that they couldn't find out of but for the 32 process, especially since there's no reason that the government would have called him as a witness of the 32 investigation. The government doesn't need to put on a complete case or prove beyond reasonable doubt a 32 investigation. They merely have to have evidence as to each element. The government could have had a 32 investigation that consisted of, hey, here's his parent query and his conviction. And his confession, let's move this down the road to the GCM.
Well, let me ask you a related question, which is, I understand that the stated purpose of Article 32 is to see whether or not there's sufficient evidence. You know, basically it's a discovery tool, but it also serves a necessary purpose, right, which is there sufficient evidence to support the alleged offenses and a recommendation by the investigating officer to the convening authority as to what disposition to make of the case, right?
Yes, ma'am.
I think, as I understand appellant today, that the argument he's making is that if there had been a 32, that perhaps the offenses would not have been sufficient evidence to go forward on the offense, or that the IO would have recommended and the convening authority would have agreed that a special court martial rather than a general court martial was warranted. What's your position on those two aspects of the appellant's argument?
Taking the reverse arc in reverse, Your Honor, there's simply no way, there's nothing for us to base the speculation that the investigating officer would say, gee, this should be in a different form or shouldn't be a court martial at all. I mean, there's no reason to believe that there was sentencing or character evidence that the accused would put on a 32. They didn't put on his trial that was somehow influenced to believe there should be a lesser form. And similarly, there's no reason to believe that the IO, considering that this was a contested trial in which he was found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and there's no reason to believe that new evidence had magically appeared when, in fact, there was less evidence than at the time of the 2001 trial. So, you know, we're stuck really speculating, but there's nothing we can see that indicates that at the time of the 32, the government would have been unable to make a prima facie case for this, yet at trial was able to make a proof beyond reasonable doubt case for this, and something had changed in between when this 32 might have occurred, especially since the 32 was requested immediately before trial. So it's not unfair for the court to assume that the evidence of 32 would have been the exact same evidence that the government put at the contested trial. If you follow what I'm saying, chronologically, they make this motion right at the arraignment of the trial starting. One would certainly hope, although I would hesitate to assume, the government's case was fully prepared and they had all that evidence ready to go.
Sure.
Well, help me work through that then based on that approach. Again, are we looking strictly at the most recent court-martial and what would have been done out of 32, or are we looking at what would have been done out of 32 had the accused had the proper information and not made a waiver at the time of the original court-martial?
My answer is twofold. The first is I would hesitate to use not have the proper information in the first trial, so I described that. And secondly, that
You're not conceding that issue, but in light of Martinelli, he didn't have before him when he made the waiver,
sure,
the knowledge that he would be charged under Clause 1 and Clause 2.
I agree. And in regards to the meat of your question, I think the real operative here is, you know, the ruling the military judge made in the second trial that you haven't shown any good cause for why I should revoke your waiver, and you're not going to, I don't see how you can tell your opponent anyway, I'm not going to order a 32. I think that's the issue. You know, trial basically, like I said, I keep coming back to this point, but at trial, the second trial, which is the opposite question here, the accused came in and just said, hey, I withdrew from my PTA, therefore I just get a 32. You know,
in terms
of surprise, shock, things, if only might have been different, if only I can have a 32 now. Whereas, you know, in cases such as Nickerson, where you didn't get his new 32, at least there he was able to make some argument that there was uncharged misconduct out there or specific things that I could point to that might have been exploited in 32 that may have made a difference. He ultimately lost on that issue, but at least in that case, there was something that could actually be pointed out that was a substance as opposed to the pure speculation that if only I had a 32 with the same evidence, I would have gotten a different form, perhaps, or I would have gotten a court martial at all.
Now, in terms of the notice issue, is it the government's position that if an individual is charged under Clause 3 with a Title 18 offense, and then when we get to trial, the government determines that he has a problem with the Title 18 offense, whether it's extraterritoriality, interstate commerce, one of those types of issues. And the government wishes to have an amendment at that time to change it to either a Clause 1 or Clause 2 offense. Is it the government's position that in all cases that is a minor change, or is the government's position that it depends on the specific circumstances of what is charged and what would have to be proved for Clause 1 and Clause 2?
I think where the sole pending change that's being made is the addition of Clause 1 and Clause 2 language, and everything else remains the same. I would think in virtually all cases that would be a minor change.
Now, your reference to pen and ink, that's rhetorical, I assume. You used it a lot in your brief. Surely, what method of modality of instrument you use to is not dispositive?
That's correct, John.
There's such emphasis on that, though, in the brief that I had to ask.
I think, Your Honor,
otherwise, people just start making pen name changes to everything, right?
I understand, Your Honor. I think at the risk of becoming testimonial, in my trial practice experience in the Air Force, pen name changes is often kind of used as rhetorical shorthand for a minor change.
Okay.
It's not the substantive consequence that would make it a major change. So, to the degree that we may have created the impression that the use of a pen to make handwritten changes somehow is the issue.
Yeah, my question goes to whether there's any change at trial when the government determines that it no longer is going to go under Title 18, whether it's pen and ink, whether it's a computer, strikeout, use markup, whatever it is. At that point, is it the government's position that in every case or almost every case or depending on factors, what is the government's position as to that type of change, whether it's a minor or major change?
The government's position would be that where an amendment is made to a specification that simply adds the prejudicial liberal discipline of services grading language and changes nothing else about the specification, that's going to be a minor change. It's not.
So adding an element to an offense is not a major change?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think Sullivan, Sullivan tells us that it doesn't have to be an LIO to be a major change. And when we look at the test laid out in the RCM, 602A, where it talks about, is it adding a party, is it adding an offense, and here where you're still under 134.
Just to be clear, you're saying per se rather than it depends.
Per se, yes.
Why shouldn't we apply the concept that the Supreme Court brought to this element issue in a case like Nieder, where the Supreme Court there said that the government's failure to have a proper charge and produce evidence with respect to an element is not necessarily prejudicial if it's a matter that's not contested. Why shouldn't we use that approach here? And that is where the element of either service discrediting or good or indiscipline wasn't present at the time of the waiver. Why shouldn't we then look and see whether there's prejudice flowing from the absence of those particular elements to determine whether or not this is a minor or major case? There may be cases in which the service discrediting or prejudicial good order and discipline is critical. That may be the focus of the case. Everybody concedes that the events took place, but the question is whether it was service discrediting. There may be other cases in which the whole case is tried about whether the events took place, and the service discrediting or prejudicial good order and discipline is simply something that counsel asked to be inferred or not inferred.
And, Your Honor, as you asked that question, I think more about your earlier question about would it be in all cases. I was thinking in terms of the context of these kinds of offenses, like the child porn offenses, that simply carried with it kind of very implicitly and obviously at least some kind of notice or implication that serious discrediting prejudice order is going to be at play. There obviously could be other OB 134, I mean, other assimilated crimes under Clause 3 where it's just not necessarily as intuitive that prejudice order or discipline is at play the way it would be.
But, I mean, does that decide whether it's a major or minor change, or does it play into whether they were prejudiced by the failure to have an Article 32? Because, I mean, either it's a major change to add an element or it's not.
I don't think that I don't believe that the per se rule should be adding elements per se.
And that's just irrespective of what offense we're talking about.
Well, I think you have to look at the offense and look at the circumstances and apply kind of the test that laid out in the RCM colleagues to determine if it's a major or minor change. You know, in the context of this case, adding prejudicial authority and discipline and service discrediting, where yeah, given the nature of this offense and given that it's the exact same offense, the exact time, the exact place, in the same way, everything else remains the same, you know, we keep that in mind as we do the analysis and asking was that under 602, was the accused likely to be misled at trial by what was going on? Was the accused ambushed and taken unfairly? Is it created a whole new offense? It's still, you know, we're talking about what it's simply doing is investigating the period of liability of the same 134 offense. Is it adding a party? Is it doing like what happened in U.S. v. Smith, where the addition of the language effectively doubled the liability the accused faced at trial? Those are the things that we look at. So when we look at this particular case and ask ourselves the question, is this a major change? I think the answer to that is going to be no. And you see, my time is up. It's been up for some time. I apologize.
You can keep going until we tell you to stop. But now might be a good time to summarize.
So in the absence of further questions, we don't see the mere fact that he withdrew from the PTA, effectively revoked the waiver, that he showed good cause, or that merely this agreement that if he withdrew from the PTA, that if there was a his care and court was improper, again, he might get a 32 control, and in this case, he's impossible.
Thank you, counsel. Defense ever bottled?
Yes, Your Honor. According to the Joint Appendix, page 58, the appellant's defense attorney in 2006, in August 2006, requested and inquired about the Article 32 period, and then in October made the motion for the Article 32 period. So, the new trial defense counsel certainly raised that issue with the government shortly after he was on the case. In this case, there was a major change that occurred in 2006. There was a new referral that occurred. Under RCM 603, the discussion implies that if the earlier specification before there was a major change, if the investigation did not cover those matters, then there should be a new investigation. And since there wasn't an investigation in this case, initially, there should be one in this case.
The new matters, then, are the matters that are now charged, the new elements.
Yes, Your Honor.
And where does the record show prejudice from the failure in that regard? That is, if we come to the conclusion that the absence of an element is a major change, does that automatically require the defense to win, or is there a requirement for showing a prejudice?
Your Honor, there's a requirement for prejudice, and in this case, the prejudice was, number one, there was no Article 32. Number two, because there was no IO to look at the evidence and to say, okay, this should be a special court-martial, or maybe not go forward in this case, point out to Staff Sergeant Nuccio, it turns out that in his case, he was more knowledgeable about the appellant was on computers, and some of the computers actually, I believe, found in Staff Sergeant Nuccio's room, and he was the initial suspect. So appellant indicates that Staff Sergeant Nuccio would be a key witness when it would come to discovery issues, especially now he's got a testimonial immunity. And
is there anything in the record to support any suggestion that the defense was not able to meet with, interview, explore everything that there was to do with Staff Sergeant Nuccio?
Your Honor, the record reflects that the motion was made, and a few short days later, that's when the court martial occurred.
That's not my question. Is there anything in the record that the defense object to trial and say we haven't had an opportunity to interview him, we're surprised by this, we didn't know about the grant of immunity, anything like that?
No, Your Honor, not in the record.
Well, is there anything not in the record that you're aware of?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
So, is the government, the defense taking the position in this case that any good cause would have to be inferred from the record as opposed to resulting from the defense establishment of good cause at trial? And on the question of whether there was good cause for getting out of the waiver and following good cause to the point of my client needs an Article 32 now because this is where we are in the whole issue of good cause there because. What is there anything that the defense pointed to in the record, or is it simply the absence of a 32 without tying that to any particular information that would have been explored at the 32?
Your Honor, on the record, appellant made the motion for 32 hearing because of cancellation of the pretrial agreement.
Right.
And waiver was contingent on the pretrial agreement.
I understand. Thank you.
RCM 810 says that in rehearings, all the procedures that apply in court martials apply to rehearings, and he would have been entitled to an Article 32 under RCM, on the principles of RCM 810.
Well, let's say that I agree with you on that point. Do we have to, where can we glean from any fact in the record or, you know, anything other than pure speculation that there was prejudice, that things would have turned out differently if he'd gotten an Article 32, either in terms of information that would have come to light that he didn't otherwise have available to him, or anything other than pure speculation on your part that it would not have been referred at all or would not have been referred to the form that it was referred to?
Your Honor, there's nothing on the record other than what's been mentioned already about potential prejudice that I've raised. At that point, Davis did not come out, and the motion was based on other Nickerson, for instance, where there was no need to show prejudice because it was a pretrial right at that point. And since Davis has come out, since the motion was raised, at that point it became clear that 59A applied as well. So, Your Honor, sum up here.
Counsel, you don't need to feel rushed. We gave the government a bit more time, so take the time you need to provide us with your summary.
In Medina, this court said that a waiver for an article for a change from actually a conviction. Let me start over, Your Honor. Medina, as applied in this case in Article 32, indicates there needs to be a knowing waiver when there's a change from a clause 3 to a clause 1 and 2 as applied in this case. The waiver of the Article 32 was not knowing, and it was not voluntary as applied to this new specification, which was effectively a major change. There was good cause for waiver if the waiver is found to still apply, because in this case, the waiver was intimately intertwined with the plea. In addition, appellant had withdrawn from the pretrial agreement as entitled to Article 32, and the prejudice, as mentioned, was the fact that it went to trial, that there was not a special court martial as it could have been, and the finding of guilt. For this reason, appellant asks this honorable court for a set aside of the finding, of the specification, and the charge, and the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for your presentation, and the case is now submitted. The court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Pause. Court stands adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow.